Hello, and welcome to the podcast portion of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, previews, reviews, and interviews with baseball authors, artists, filmmakers, musicians, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture. Because that's our slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Welcome back to part two of our conversation with Michael Leahy, author of The Last Innocents, The Collision of the Turbulent 60s and the Los Angeles Dodgers. You know, when I approach authors to see if they'd be interested in coming on this podcast, I always tell them that it's recorded live on the phone as a precaution against some colorful language, let's say, but also that it takes about 20 minutes or so because I'm cognizant of their time and how busy they are. But I always hope that things will continue, that they won't be looking at the clock. And as you can tell now, that was the case with Michael Leahy. And I'm very happy to present part two of our bookshelf conversation.
There's a theme that runs through the book. The Dodgers played in the days before free agency, so you still have the front office trying to lowball their players, even their star players. Contracts are almost always for a year, and something that's unheard of today, salaries are actually cut if a player had a poor season.
Right.
When Maury broke Cobb's record, he was almost afraid to ask for a raise.
Yeah.
There's a paternalism that owners instinctively knew what's best for the players, and they needed to keep the players hungry. The Yankees front office held a carrot of a World Series check as motivation for their players to do well and forcing them to accept a smaller deal. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, all great points. There was a I think you're absolutely right, Ron, and hit on absolutely the right word when you referenced paternalism. That was the mindset of that era for Dodger management and the management of so many other teams. And I think it is perhaps best reflected by a story Dick Trzewski told me. Trzewski was, you know, again, this selfless ball player who was appreciated by his teammates and by management. And in 1963, of course, the Dodgers had won the World Series over the Yankees in a four-game sweep. The Dodgers had collected a winning World Series share, and in Dick Trzewski's case, his World Series share was greater than his regular season salary. So that enabled Dick in the off season after the 1963 season to take his wife on a modest vacation, but a nice vacation nonetheless, and have a little extra money for creature comforts around their modest home in Los Angeles. And of course, this was the era, Ron, where players typically worked in the off season, and in fact, during that 63 off season, Dick was selling cars at a Chevrolet dealership in Los Angeles. Found himself at the dealership, for instance, on the day in November of 63 when he learned that President Kennedy had been assassinated. Dick was, Dick worked this off-season job, but in the aftermath of the 63 season, also had this World Series check so that he could do a little things. Well, in 64, the Dodgers had a difficult season. They did not go to the World Series, and somebody came up to Dick at the batting cage late in the 64 season and said, "What are you going to do for a vacation this year?" And Dick knew he didn't, with his salary, which was under $10,000, knew there would be no money for an off-season vacation. So he said, we'll probably go to Catalina, which was a short ways from Los Angeles, this little island where, think about it, like Disneyland. It was that modest. And so the next day, Buzzy Bevesi came up to Dick and said, "I hear you're going to Hawaii." and for your vacation. And Dick said, Hawaii? What are you talking about, Bavese? And what are you talking about, Buzzy? And Bavese handed him a check that, for several thousand dollars, that enabled him to go to Hawaii. Bavese paid for the trip to Hawaii. And so Trzewski was grateful, but Bavese also made it clear to him and others that when these acts of paternalism came along, they should not have any mistaken notion that things were going to be any different at the bargaining table. And when some players would sit down with Bavese at the bargaining table, and of course no agents were allowed in, that word agent wasn't even in the lexicon at that point. If Bavese got frustrated with players' reluctance to accept his offers, and these negotiations were typically supposed to last no more than 15 minutes or so. If Bavese got frustrated, sometimes he would say to a player, as he did to Al Ferrara once, take it or go pump gas. And the players typically caved. And when I asked, I interviewed, if you can call it that, one of Bavese's sons, Peter Bavese, himself a very a baseball executive with great stature. And when I asked Peter about his father's mindset toward the players, he said that his father looked upon the players as he did upon his own sons, right? And I'm paraphrasing Peter's answer now, but it was essentially he would help them out off the field. When they got into jams, he would sometimes make sure they had a little extra money during the off season, but that he treated them like their sons. He gave, you know, Peter said, he gave us, his sons, an allowance, but we were not going to get any more than that. And that he looked upon players sort of the same way. He would treat them like sons when they were in a jam, but they weren't going to get a dollar more than what Buzzy thought the correct salary ought to be. So this paternalism did exist from the outset in relations, Bavese and O'Malley believing that they knew best what these players deserved. And it was no accident, of course, that even through 1966, the only Dodgers to have ever earned as much as $100,000 were Sandy and Don Drysdale. Extraordinarily, Maury Wills would never receive $100,000 during a career that concluded with the 1972 season. After the 1971 season, where Maury had had another great year and almost had led the Dodgers to a divisional title at the age of 39, Maury thought his time to join the magic $100,000 club had finally arrived. So he sat down for a negotiation with Al Campanis, who was one of Bavese's successors and who possessed much the same mindset as Bavese when it came to salaries, and who was, of course, still answering to Walter O'Malley, who the tight-fisted Walter O'Malley, who had made his made clear his loathing of any player other than a Koufax or Drysdale earning as much as $100,000. But Maury had thought that off this great 1971 season, his time had finally arrived to join the elite $100,000 club, be a part of the Aarons and Robinsons and Drysdales, Koufaxes, etc. So he sits down, and Al Campanis offers him $97,000. And Morey thinks, well, that's not a bad opening offer. He thinks to himself, I'm close. I'm just going to have to sit here now and ask for $100,000. This is going to happen now. I've never been so close, never have been offered $97,000. It's going to happen. So he thanked Campanis for the offer and said, you know, Al, it would mean so much to me if I could be paid $100,000. And Campanis said no. He said that, anticipating that question, he had already run it by O'Malley, and O'Malley had said no, and that the offer was $97,000. And at some point, Morey started pleading, saying it would mean so much to him. It was getting later in his career now. He had given the Dodgers so much, had played at times for so little money, and Campanis refused to budge. And Morey, in his desperation, finally said, Al, if you give me a $100,000 contract, I so want $100,000. If you give me a $100,000 contract, I will right now, right here, write you a check for $3,000. Just give me a $100,000 contract. And Campanis said no. Yes. And so Morey finally caved in, signed for the $97,000. So even Morey Wills, this extraordinary player who chances are, I believe, ultimately he'll be elected to the Hall of Fame, never earned $100,000. So this, and Dodger management thought that they had treated these players quite well. And, you know, so it's a complicated with O'Malley and with Bavese and later Campanis, et cetera. It's a complicated history, because on the one hand, when you look at a Walter O'Malley, Walter O'Malley made a major social contribution in the 1950s when, in the wake of Jackie Robinson's entrance into the game in the late 40s, Walter O'Malley was determined that there be real and full integration of his ball club. And so the Dodgers were the first majority. You could look out on the field on some days, and the Dodgers were, you know, a majority starting black ball club. And Walter O'Malley deserves praise for all that. On the other hand, though, that tight-fisted quality and that paternalism and that refusal in moments to deal fairly, you know, there's an anecdote in the book, Ron, which you're well familiar with, where Bavese actually duped players during salary negotiations, putting phony contracts of other players in front of them in an effort to persuade them, the players at his table, that they were asking for too much money. So there was outright duplicity in moments. So, you know, that kind of duplicity on the part of Bavese and O'Malley's tight-fistedness unwittingly lit the match, helped light the match that led to the creation of the Players Union. And so it's a complicated history here, and that paternalism that you cite is absolutely at the core of it.
You had mentioned earlier about real-life intruding in baseball, and Trudeski. You've heard about the assassination of Kennedy. This book, your book, is told not in the vacuum of just the game on the field. It talks about the context of the culture of the 60s. There's a famous story about Willie Horton, an outfielder for the Tigers, rushing out in uniform when Detroit was undergoing the race riots in 1968. Did anything similar to that happen for any of the Dodger players in Watts in 65?
It did, and Lou Johnson often, during the Watts riots, spent some of his time riding home with the great all-star catcher of the Dodgers, great African-American catcher of the Dodgers, John Roseboro. And they had to take a different route home because Many of the roads were blocked by rioters in Los Angeles. Police department officers in L.A. County, deputy sheriffs. So they certainly encountered some of that. Roseboro found himself sitting on his porch, ready to defend it with a gun if necessary. And and Lou, who had been, had suffered enormously under racism in his native Kentucky as a youth, and then experienced much the same in parts of Los Angeles during during the middle 60s, a period when housing segregation, Ron, was rampant, where many of the black stars of the Dodgers could not move into nearly all white enclaves of Los Angeles. All these feelings were part and parcel of African American players' lives in the 60s, and so it was, it was complicated. Lou could absolutely understand. Lou and John Roseboro could absolutely understand what had given rise to the Watts riots, and at the same time, for somebody like John Roseboro, he was in a position where he had to protect his property. And then you had somebody like Maury Wills, who Maury had invested in a dry cleaners that sat fairly close to Watts. And he had a white partner. And Maury received a call at the start of the riots from his white partner, who asked him if Maury would come down to the dry cleaners and essentially stand in front of it so that if the rioting spread to that street, that Maury could tell rioters that this dry cleaners was a black-owned business. So you had the strange sight, the odd sight of Maury Wills, this MVP, a couple years earlier in baseball, the game's greatest base stealer, an all-star shortstop, one of the Dodgers' most visible faces, standing in front of this dry cleaners as the riot was going on a few miles away, and he would stand there for hours in the hot sun and then go to the ballpark. And he did this for several days. So African American players on the Dodgers in particular were impacted by the riots. But even white players were uncertain about what the next days would bring and moved by what they were seeing. Dick Trzewski talks about going to church services on a Sunday during the riots, and as he on his way there, seeing tanks on the street, and Jeff Torborg, who was concerned about his own well-being, would drive to Dodger Stadium with a gun resting on the floor of the back seat. So it impacted all these guys. It was an year or two, Ron, I guess, where, players aren't insulated in the same ways they are today. Lou Johnson did not earn enough money and was barred, again, by housing segregation from living in the kind of community that would have insulated him. So he was, essentially on the edge of the riot area, as was, John Roseboro again. So, it was an era where you could not insulate yourself if you were an American athletic figure, black or white, from what was going on around you. And whether it was civil rights or urban strife or the Vietnam War, these players always felt vulnerable.
Now, you mentioned Vietnam, which was something I was going to bring up. Historically, baseball has been written about as something of a palliative for the men in the military, a morale booster. I forget if it was Wes Parker and a couple of other players who visited wounded soldiers. It doesn't seem to have the same effect on them as it did during the World War II generation, and I'm wondering if baseball just didn't mean as much in the 60s as it did a generation before.
It's such a great question. I think it says something powerfully about how these servicemen had felt betrayed when they returned. There is an anecdote that I know you saw in the book, Ron, where, and you referenced it absolutely correctly, where Wes Parker is among a small group of players who occasionally visited a veteran administration's hospital in West Los Angeles, and Wes was alone among these players when he would sometimes sit down with small groups of servicemen and who had returned injured from Vietnam. And he thought to himself, he would be introduced by a PR person and then begin speaking to these small groups, which could be, you know, a half dozen returning servicemen or a dozen. And the first time he was introduced, you know, he thought, oh, this, hopefully I'll be able to pick up some spirits. This is probably a nice opportunity for them, and I'm certainly glad to be here. He's thinking all this to himself. And he thought, I'll do what the best I can do to cheer these guys up, talk about Dodger baseball, right? Talk about not only his own achievements on the field, but more importantly, what the greatest Dodger stars are doing, what the team is doing, etc. And he'd get into the spiel, and suddenly become aware that these players, that or rather his listeners, these returning servicemen, were hardly paying attention, and that they weren't being rude. They just couldn't concentrate. They were lost in their own fog, and he recognized the stares of men who were staring blankly into something that was 10,000 miles away, in the Vietnamese paddies and jungles, and that 10,000 mile stare. And Wes would look at these expressions, and occasionally these guys would sort of make eye contact with him, and he thought he could read their expressions, which in his mind were saying, you know, thank you for coming, it's nice of you to try to cheer us up, thank you for saying all you're saying, but what can you do about my missing leg? What can you do about my missing arm? Things are going to get no better for me here, and your kind words aren't going to change that. You know, that's what Wes was sort of reading into those expressions. And, of course, for Wes, who was always beset by these questions about his own worth, it added to his feeling that he had not given them what they deserved. That, you know, Wes would think sometimes, my gosh, you know, maybe if Mickey Mantle were here, that Mickey could cheer him up. Somebody of that renown, or a Sandy, or a Willie Mays. But you know, Wes would feel sort of inadequate to the task. But, of course, no one could have cheered such men up. They had lost limbs, and they were in their early 20s. They were younger, in most cases, than Wes. So World War II was different in the sense that America won that war. By the time Wes saw these guys, America was bogged down in a war that it looked unlikely to win at a war that a stalemate at best was in the cards, and a war that was going to cost, by the time West saw these men, a war that was going to still cost tens of thousands of young Americans their lives. So when, you know, these players got, or these servicemen got back there, baseball couldn't relieve that pain. And I think Wes, if that experience did anything for Wes, who had grown up in a conservative Republican family and who was, when it came to most issues, a conservative Republican himself, those visits made him a fierce, or played a role in making him a fierce opponent of the war in Vietnam. So those visits changed Wes as well.
It almost sounds like this book could have been called The Lost Innocence, but in fact it is The Last Innocence, the collision of the turbulent 60s and the Los Angeles Dodgers, published by Harper. We've been talking to the author, Michael Leahy. Michael, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much, Ron.
And that was the conclusion of the Bookshelf Conversation with Michael Leahy. Tune in again next time when we'll have another interesting guest from the world of baseball and pop culture. Until then, please visit Ron Kaplan's baseballbookshelf.com for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews. And if you have a question or comment, suggestion, please send them to me at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you later.
If old man Columbus had sat in the stands, had seen Matty pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, "Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land."